dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bass to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you had taken from somebody else. And this we go.
You're listening to episode 586 of Unwelcome Guests, The Iron Triangle. I'm Robin Upton. This week on the show, we're looking at the confluence of interests between big government, the military, and big manufacturers, for example, arms dealers. These nominally separate institutions are, as we shall see, increasingly closely interrelated. Now, this is not something new. We heard last week about how plutocracy has long been in cahoots with arms dealers to exert pressure over national governments, but the extent to which it's carried out and the openness with which politicians work for weapons dealers may have escaped you if you've been too reliant on commercially controlled media, which are, of course, amongst the prime warmongers. We adapt two independently produced videos on this topic. The second one, Ethos, looks in more broad terms at what Eisenhower referred to as the military-industrial complex. But for that, let's look particularly at the Carlyle Group. This is a video from 2004 by author and investigator Dan Breardy, whose voice you shall hear next.
Carlyle is a massive private equity firm. And what a private equity firm does is essentially raise money from wealthy individuals and companies and funds, and then turns and invests that money in a slightly higher risk form of investing than, say, the stock market or the bond market.
What they do is they buy the stock directly from the company. They take ownership shares and often controlling shares, but they do not buy it on the public market. And they often have control of the companies they buy, which means that they do not have to, because the companies are privately owned, privately controlled, they don't have to, they're not subject to the securities exchange laws in this country.
They'll purchase the company for a fraction of what it's really worth, and then turn the company around and sell it off for a huge profit. It's called the buyout practice.
The list of knowledgeable institutional investors in aerospace defense is a fairly short list. And I think it would be widely acknowledged that at the top of that list is the Carlyle Group, located here in Washington, D.C., and considered by most people to be the premier investor in aerospace defense over quite a number of years.
What is new about Carlyle is the size and dimension of their success. My understanding is they are now the 11th or 12th largest defense contractor, a multi-billion dollar annual enterprise with an almost obscenely high profit margin.
So please welcome Frank Finelli. Frank?
Well, super. It's great to be here back at the conferences that are put on here. As Jerry mentioned, the Carlyle Group, we're headquartered here in Washington, D.C. It's a global private equity merchant bank, and we probably do more leveraged buyout and venture capital investing related to defense and dual-use technology than any other private equity firm in the world. The defense industry valuation will grow primarily from two factors. One is that either the size of the defense pie gets bigger, as it has been over several years, or the slice of the pie related to that particular part of the defense industry gets bigger.
The Carlyle Group plays in industries and in an area that are heavily influenced by politics. And in order to do that effectively, they hire some of the best-known politicians from all over the world.
The first thing is, you know, where do the dollars go? What is the defense budget and what does it look like? This is the way it's commonly captured by the DoD controller. And there's roughly $380 billion in the FY04 defense budget that was recently submitted.
They hire defense experts like Frank Carlucci or Frank Finelli. They hire politicians like George Bush Sr. or James Baker III. And they hire businessmen, a number of, MBAs, Ivy League MBAs, very, very bright business people from around the world.
Most people think about this topic as simply the Iron Triangle, the relationship of the Pentagon with Congress and industry. So I'm a practitioner who has been on all three sides of this triangle over the last 25 years or so, and it really has been a lot of fun.
The Iron Triangle is in some ways a uniquely American phenomenon. It's the confluence of the military, big business, and politics. And the combination of these three things is something that a number of U.S. presidents in the past have warned against. In particular, Dwight Eisenhower was very upfront about warning against the possibility of creating a military-industrial complex. By that, he means a group of a business built around defense and military that becomes so large and so powerful that it's actually able to influence the politics of war. Nothing sort of personifies that euphemism of the Iron Triangle better than the Carlyle Group. They have it all in one under one roof. Founded basically on a fluke. A couple of guys, this guy Steve Norris, who was a Marriott executive, got together with David Rubenstein, who was a former Carter aide. The two of them met frequently at a hotel in New York called the Carlyle Hotel. It's up on the Upper East Side. It's a beautiful, old, plush hotel.
I always liked Carlyle. It sounded English. It sounded old-worldly. It just seemed to have the right kind of ring to it.
So it was essentially, this sort of fabricated legacy of sounding like they had a history of success and big money, old money.
And ultimately, at the end of the day, no one had a better idea.
But they decided, they made a very strange decision. They decided to base the company in Washington, D.C., which at the time no one could really understand because all private equity firms of this nature were based in New York.
But as we talked to people about it, particularly some of the people that both David Rubenstein and I worked with, they thought we'd lost our minds, that it was too late, that what do we know about establishing a merchant banking business? I was a finance guy from Marriott and David was a lawyer. But we had this dream to build a merchant bank, a private equity investment firm that could take capital and intermediate that capital into companies or real estate or venture capital. At the outset, we really didn't envision entirely where it might go. We saw it simply an opportunity to take advantage of Washington and the people here and the access that people had to transactions.
So to base the company in Washington, D.C. was a very strange decision, but as it turned out, it proved to be an extremely successful decision because of the direction that Carlyle eventually went in, which was to play in these very heavily government-regulated industries and to use ex-politicians to sort of pave the way for them.
We started buying shares of a company called Fairchild, which was here in the Washington area, because we thought it was very cheap.
And what kind of company was that?
It's a defense business. They had a satellite business, which we thought was very attractive and undervalued. And we invested in Fairchild. At one point, we had, I think, almost 25% of the company. Mm-hmm. And it was ultimately sold, and we made an enormous amount of money. And we began to see the opportunities in that area, and which was one of the reasons why, at the end of the Reagan administration, we were very interested in Frank Carlucci.
I will name as the next Secretary of Defense the best qualified man in America to carry on CAP's work, Frank Carlucci.
When Frank Carlucci came on board, he was coming straight from the Pentagon as Secretary of Defense. He had just, Reagan's term had just finished and Carlucci retired. he came on board and really took them in a completely new direction into defense. This was a time, bear in mind, where defense properties were worth almost nothing because the Cold War had just ended. And this huge military buildup that had taken place during the 80s had suddenly evaporated, which marked a great opportunity. And no one knew that better than Frank Carlucci, who had been in the Pentagon watching this whole trend happen firsthand. So Carlucci came on board and was able to take Carlisle 180 degrees in another direction. Sure enough, a year, 2 years later, the Gulf War hit. And everybody knows that wartime is boom time for the defense industry. So once the Gulf War hit, these properties skyrocketed again. And Carlisle made a ton of money. They did very, very well. They really cleaned up during that 3 or 4 year swing. And after that, Carlisle said, hey, you know, having these politicians on board is pretty great. I mean, they know things that nobody else knows. In fact, you know, Frank Carlucci was setting up policies while he was in office as Secretary of Defense that he's now capitalizing on as chairman of Carlisle Group. And, you know, it's a brilliant scheme if you think about it. You set up the policies, you leave office, you go into business, and then you exploit those policies. They picked up George Bush, James Baker.
Richard Darman is over there, who was a former budget director in the White House.
Arthur Levitt, the former SEC chairman. William Kennard, the former FCC chairman.
In Europe, you have former Prime Minister of England, John Major. Karl Otto Paul, from the head of the German Central Bank. Eberhard Kuhnheim, who is the chairman of the supervisory board of BMW. The Asia part, former Prime Minister of Thailand. Former President of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos. And at one point, also, the former Prime Minister of South Korea was on their board, a man named Mr. Park, who used to head up the largest steel company in South Korea.
The list just goes on and on and on. So these guys carry a tremendous amount of influence, and they are able to predict trends in global markets, predict trends in political shifts. And in some ways, and this is the sort of the most insidious part, and if you want to be cynical about the Carlisle Group, you have to be concerned about their ability to influence these trends and actually affect change in government policy, which would positively affect their investments.
Former government officials tended before Carlisle to go to academic institutions, or they tended to, some just retired, or many of them became lobbyists. Mm-hmm. Well, for someone like Jim Baker, who really had been at the pinnacle of American power for over 10 years, he'd been chief of staff, he'd been secretary of the treasury, ultimately secretary of state, for Jim Baker to be a lobbyist or even to be a lawyer was not something that was terribly interesting to him.
If you're a Republican during a Democratic administration in the White House, for example, someone like James Baker, you're able to revolve out of the White House into the Carlisle Group, work there for a period of time, and then when that Democratic administration is through, like Clinton's was through in 2000, you're able to revolve right back into the White House. Colin Powell did that. Colin Powell did a little consulting for the Carlisle Group. He knows the guys very well. He knows Frank Carlucci very well. Frank Carlucci was his mentor as he came up through the ranks. And I think his relationship with the Carlisle Group personifies the gray area that the Carlisle Group works within. Some of these guys are never officially hired. You know, some of them are only put on retainer. Some of them are paid in very ambiguous ways, like through investments that they make through the Carlisle Group or the amount of money that they help raise, that kind of thing. So it's never really clear at any given time who exactly is working for the Carlisle Group. No one really knows unless, you know, they officially – Unless the Carlisle Group wants you to know. If the Carlisle Group wants you to know, then they put them up on the website and they put them in their brochures and that kind of thing. But if you look on the Carlisle website today, you don't see George Bush Sr.'s name anywhere, although he is working for the Carlisle Group. George Bush Sr. is a fundraiser. He is the kind of guy who can go into Kuwait or Saudi Arabia, where they love him, pack the house, and get these guys to open up their wallets and give money to the Carlisle Group. That's his role. But if you look in over the history of this company, George Bush Sr. has clearly met with business leaders one-on-one, met with political leaders in South Korea and in Saudi Arabia, And that would lead one to believe that he's doing much, much more than just giving speeches for the Carlyle Group.
Charles Lewis, Center for Public Integrity.
I got a call one day from Carlyle after I blasted them in the papers, and they said that maybe we should get together and talk. We had breakfast at the Mayflower Hotel. Everything was going just fine. We were eating our eggs and bacon and talking about the weather, and then somewhere in the middle to the late part of the meal, he said, "How come you're trashing former President Bush?" And he said, "He's a very, very good, decent man, and you know, I think it's really unfair what you've been doing about former President Bush." And I said, "Well, you know, all you have to do is tell the world what exactly he's doing for you." And I said, "What is he doing for you? And what's his position there? How much money did he make last year?" And he said, "Well, I can't tell you how much he made. He has no official position." And I said, "Yes, he does. He was the head of your business council in Asia. Last I checked, he still is." And he goes, "Well, that's just an advisory post." And he said, "He just gives speeches." And I go, "How much does he get a speech?" And I said, "I heard it's well over $100,000 every time he opens his mouth." And I said, "So if it's just a few speeches, why don't you just tell us where and when and how much? And then people like me will go away." And he said, "Well, that's not possible."
Tim Shorrock, journalist for The Nation.
George Bush Sr. made it after he left the presidency. He was working for Carlyle and made several swings through East Asia, going to Thailand, going to South Korea and other places, sort of looking for investment opportunities for Carlyle. And Carlyle finally settled on South Korea. And then the way that overlaps with policy is, during the Asia crisis, the International Monetary Fund, came in with this rescue package for South Korea that the United States backed, and the U.S. used the IMF crisis to push through deregulation and changes in rules around foreign ownership, the changes that they'd been unable to press through, you know, maybe 25 or 30 years of trade policy. In a matter of months, under this IMF package, they just rammed all these changes through. And one of the changes was allowing foreign banks to take ownership shares, controlling shares of Korean banks. And so Carlyle has been right in there, and they've bought one of the largest banks there, commercial banks. And so you can say that, Bush Sr. didn't cut the deal, but when someone comes of that stature, that gives a kind of stamp of approval for, you know, people wondering, you know, who this investment group is. They say, well, it's backed by the former president of the United States, and it carries a lot of weight.
I have said that it's the worst kind of conflict of interest, particularly when your son is the president of the United States. So while Junior is talking to heads of state about war and other weighty matters, Papa is talking to them or having conversations with them about Carlyle. And it's just, I find it disgusting.
Carlyle bought United Defense, which is one of the largest military contractors in the country, in 1997, and they went on to work with United Defense on a very specific program called the Crusader. The Crusader is a huge howitzer. It's a mobile gun. But it came under fire by a defense panel that was paid to review the all defense purchases of the Pentagon.
Cynthia McKinney, member of Congress.
One fateful day, we were having a hearing on the upcoming defense authorization legislation, which is going to authorize almost an unprecedented amount of money for defense spending, $400 billion.
After September 11th, huge defense money was unearthed.
Our men and women, you deserve the best weapons, the best equipment, and the best training. And therefore, I've asked Congress for a one-year increase of more than $48 billion for national defense, the largest increase in a generation.
The defense panel looked at the Crusader weapon in 1998, and they determined that it was too big and too slow for the modern-day warfare that the United States was likely to engage in. And the panel recommended that the gun contract be terminated.
We need to be agile and mobile, and therefore we need to replace aging aircraft and get ready to be able to defend freedom with the best equipment possible.
Cynthia McKinney.
Members of the Pentagon had come and testified on Capitol Hill and said, no, 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 no. We don't want the Crusader because it doesn't fit in with our priorities. But as a part of that $48.1 billion increase in the $400 billion defense request that came down from the president, there inside there was money for the Crusader missile. So then I started doing my research, and I learned that was the Crusader missile was manufactured by United Defense Industries, and that that company was owned by the Carlyle Group, and that the president's father was on the payroll of the Carlyle Group. And I said to myself, now, in all of the ethics briefings that we've had in Congress, this is something that we're supposed to stay away from in our own personal conduct. So when the time came for us to vote, our committee to vote on the defense authorization bill, I voted no. And I also wrote a dissent, and prominently featured in my dissent is mention of the Carlyle Group and its relationship to the Crusader missile. And then that's when everything began to fall apart.
What ended up happening was a wave of sentiment against the Crusader began to build on Capitol Hill and within the Department of Defense. And this was something that the Carlyle Group didn't foresee. And they began to wield their influence. They sent people around to key politicians, representatives, and senators, began lobbying very heavily, and was able to keep this gun program alive despite an overwhelming sentiment against it.
They didn't realize that there would be this ensuing scrutiny of the request, and therefore, when a little bit of sunshine, which is a great disinfectant, was shed on this particular request and the relationship between the current president and the former president and this particular weapon system, maybe at that point it was decided we'd better not deal with this, and so they didn't.
Eventually the noise around that got so strong that there was really nothing left to do but to cancel this gun program. And Donald Rumsfeld did cancel the program in a very public public ceremony, but not until the gun had been kept alive long enough that the company, United Defense, was able to go public. It did very well, and the Carlyle Group made $237 million in that one day.
And what happened to you?
Well, I was excoriated in the press. I was vilified. I was called unpatriotic. And then a very strange thing happened in my election. I'm a Democrat. What the Republicans did was the Republicans went out and got a black woman who was a Republican to run as a Democrat in my Democratic primary. And then 47,000 Republicans crossed over and voted in my Democratic primary. And of course, they had done their homework and their research, and they realized that generally on average, I would get about 48,000 votes on a primary, generally on average. You know, give or take 100 here, 100 there, but generally is about 48,000. So what the Republicans did, and this was not just a mere accident. This, of course, was planned. And they made sure that at least 47,000, and we can name them. We have their names, addresses, telephone numbers, so we know 47,000, right, to match the number of Democrats that would generally turn out, voted in my election. And of course, I couldn't, of course, in the circumstances like that, come out on the with the longer stick when the election tally had ended.
People should ask questions about Carlo. The problem is, what member of Congress, Democrat or Republican, wants to go and criticize a grandfatherly former U.S. president whose son happens to be the sitting president? I mean, why don't you just take a gun and shoot your leg off? I mean, you know, it is not going to be very popular in Washington, D.C. You're not going to be invited to White House dinners. You're going to be shut out on the Hill when you deal with certain members who won't forget that you trashed a former president and his son.
If you have an organization that is able to operate behind the scenes without real accountability, and that same organization has the ability to ruin political careers for people who are a little bit too inquisitive or a little bit too honest, or to shape public thinking, then we have the means for a kind of control globally that is probably unprecedented.
It's sort of like shadow boxing with a ghost. You can't find the ghost. You can't read their reports because they're privately held, and there's no obvious litigation against them. No one in Congress has had a hearing about them. They're so powerful, no one wants to touch it, because of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. Just kidding. So we have this problem here. This is a mysterious, immensely powerful company with virtually no scrutiny.
From a 2001 White House press conference.
In the White House view, there's no ethical conflict in former President Bush and former Secretary of State Jim Baker using their world contacts. World leaders to represent one of the most well-known military arms dealers, the Carlyle Group.
The president has full faith that his family will conform with all proper ethics laws, and will act properly in their conduct, and that's exactly what they've been done, and there are no questions that we...
It's okay former President Bush to go to the Middle East leaders and sell guns and tanks and planes.
Again, the president has full confidence that all members of his family are acting in full accordance with all ethics laws.
On September 11th, in somewhat of a horrible coincidence, the Carlyle Group was holding their annual investor meeting here in Washington, D.C., at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. George Bush Sr. was at the meeting. The Carlyle Group said that he left the night before September 11th and was on his way to some location in the Midwest. And I talked to someone who was at the meeting, and they told me that the whole crew of Carlyle, including Frank Carlucci and James Baker and David Rubenstein, along with Shafiq bin Laden, who was a representative of the bin Laden family and their fortunes, were all in the same room together watching the events of September 11th take place. I was totally shocked. I just couldn't believe that all of these people were in the same room watching these events happen. You know, it's just to see a confluence of international people of such political influence and intrigue to be gathered at the same place at the same time while something that affects all of them in completely different ways took place was just an amazing, amazing scene in my mind.
William Harton, World Policy Institute.
One of the more embarrassing things that happened was after September 11th, it emerged that the bin Laden family construction company had some money in Carlyle. And after initially denying this, it ended up that George Herbert Walker Bush had met with members of the bin Laden family in one of his trips to Saudi Arabia.
Stephen Norris, ex-director of Carlyle Group.
The bin Laden family had been introduced to Carlyle far
many years before President Bush ever became associated with Carlyle. And they were introduced in a quite legitimate way as a potential investor in one of our investment funds, which they did invest in. And in addition, we offered up and did perform certain financial advisory work in connection with an investment they were thinking about, and indeed one that they did make in the United States, where there was simply hard business analysis and advice rendered. I can tell you, Bakr bin Laden, in his wildest imagination, I suspect, never imagined that Osama would go and do what he did. So then you roll forward 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden 9/11 has happened, and the first thing you know is, well, President Bush is associated with Carlyle, and Carlyle has some bin Laden money. Well, what's going on here?
The relationships between Carlyle and Saudi Arabia began when Steve Norris developed a very nascent relationship with Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who is a very wealthy, very flamboyant Saudi Arabian prince who loves the United States and loves to invest his money in the United States.
There was always a running joke. You know, there's always been periods where there were capital excess capital, and people would try to figure out how to access that. For a while, it was the Japanese, and it's always been the Kuwaitis and so forth.
And now it was the Saudis.
And that was the Saudis, and people would say, let's try to find a prince to do something. I mean, it was the kind of thing you just said. It was humorous, and no one really. So I remember when I got a call from Dick Paulson saying, we have a prince we want you to talk to. I said, right, what else do you want me to do? What are you trying to do here? Do you want me to take you to lunch? I mean, what is it you really want? He said, no, you got to take this seriously. So I said, all right, okay. Because everybody had heard these stories for years. Prince Al-Waleed is the grandson of the founder of the kingdom. It's Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, and Prince Talal, his father, had actually spent a fair amount of time around Washington, in fact, owned a major estate in Washington at one point in time.
At the time, this was in the early 90s, Citigroup, which is America's largest bank, was faltering. It was in serious trouble. It was in danger of declaring bankruptcy. And Steve was able to put together a deal between the prince and Citigroup in which the prince invested $590 million into Citicorp. And an investment like this was enough to save the bank. And it was a big deal. It was the biggest deal that Carlyle had ever made.
But then through the prince, you got also in contact with the other
Yes, through the profile and then, as I said, we'd hired this gentleman, Basil Rahim, to introduce us. And so we went to meet with a number of Saudi families. And in fact, as you know, one of the families that was introduced to Carlyle and to me in those days was the bin Laden family.
The reason that all of this was able to happen is that the United States had just completed the Gulf War in, I think, 1991. And the Saudi monarchy was eternally grateful for what the United States had done. It had restabilized the Middle East.
The big spur was the Gulf War, and people seeing, you know, Bush Sr. and James Baker as the heroes of the Gulf War.
Charles Freeman, American ambassador to Saudi Arabia, 1989 to 92.
The bargain that was struck basically gave the United States preferred access to Saudi energy in return for protection against foreign foes. And when the requirement arose in 1990, the United States kept its end of the bargain, stepped forward and helped to defend the kingdom and then liberate Kuwait. And the result was that there was an enormous outburst of good feeling in both countries. Trade boomed, and the military relationship, of course, became stronger than ever before.
The Saudi people close to the Saudi royal family, as a favor to their benefactors Bush and Baker, encouraged private Saudi business people to invest in the Carlyle Group.
A lot of what I was doing was trying to convince Prince Fahad Abdullah, who I think was an Air Force general, but also he was the minister in charge of the offset program, that Carlyle would be a good financial advisor.
Carlyle managed this program for Saudi Arabia, which essentially was a program that encouraged investment from foreign countries into the kingdom, but the money that was made from those investments, what had to be reinvested, some percentage of it had to be reinvested in the kingdom.
You'd say, Your Highness, look, we have access at a higher level to some of these companies who have offset obligations. We think will be helpful to you in getting that interest generated. Now, they're not going to go do something just because Jim Baker says, why don't you do this? Now, can you get a meeting? Yes. Can we go in and make a presentation to the right operating group? And if it makes sense, are they going to take it seriously? Yes. That's what Jim Baker can do.
So Carlisle was managing this program, which made them, in some ways, a gatekeeper to the investment community in Saudi Arabia. I mean, they knew where the money was coming from and where it was going to. So they had a very unique position in Saudi Arabia and grew very close with the royal family, with the Bin Laden family, and they were able to really cozy up with the Saudis and get a lot of investments.
William Hartle, World Policy Institute.
And this became a huge arena for corruption, because instead of just paying a bribe to somebody in the royal family, now you could set them up in business. And you could say, well, this business is part of our offset commitment to you that goes with this arms sale. And so we're going to take, you know, this son of this prince and create a little company for him that's going to be funded by Boeing. But all Boeing's doing is recycling the money out of the arms deals. They get $9 billion, they kick some of it back. So Carlisle, I think, was brought in to try to put some legitimacy on this process.
That was the foot in the door into Saudi Arabia. From there, they were able to expand their business in the kingdom through, they bought a company called Vanel.
The Vanel Corporation is sensitive. It took the company 5 years to win the contract with the Saudis, and the negative interest displayed by some in Congress and the media has made the company men less than enthusiastic about talking about the Saudi agreement.
We've been in business since 1931, and we've been in Saudi Arabia. We ran the Dhahran Air Base for 5 years for the U.S. government, and we've had technical services operations since 1944.
I was on the board of directors of Vanel for about a year and a half. Carlisle really didn't own that company directly. It was acquired by BDM, which was a company that we owned or had a controlling interest in, which we'd acquired, as I say earlier, as I mentioned. And Vanel, from what I could see as a director, and as I say, I was a director of this company for a year and a half, was simply in the business of providing advice and training to the Saudi National Guard.
These are Saudi Arabian recruits at the United States Naval Training Center in San Diego. Classes are conducted in English, but when the men drill, the commands are strictly in Arabic, and the marching style is British.
The Saudi National Guard's main purpose is to defend the Saudi monarchy against internal threats. So this wasn't the case of a U.S. company helping them protect themselves from Iran or another country. It was if there is a challenge to Saudi rule from the Saudi people, this U.S. company is going to help the Saudi National Guard put down that rebellion.
Charles Freeman talking about a bomb attack in Riyadh.
As I recall, there were 4 deaths, and this was attributed to Saudis with connections to the Hezbollah movement backed by Iran.
Initially, there was talk that Iran might have been behind it. But since that time, there's been discussion that it was fundamentalists linked to the network now known as Al-Qaeda. And when you see the kind of litany of Al-Qaeda operations every time there's a new terrorist attack, this will generally be included. It was a very strategic decision because the people behind that bombing were well aware that United States companies were directly intertwined with the protection and sustenance of the Saudi regime.
It was an American presence. There's no question about that. It was an American presence in Saudi, and that's been part of the whole Bin Laden theme, is that you've got infidels on the Saudi soil, and I suspect that Vanel is an inviting target for those kinds of people.
I've spoken to people in the Pentagon and the services who think it was a huge blunder to keep so many U.S. forces in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War, that was just a provocation, that was just giving Osama bin Laden kind of a big billboard to use to recruit people to say, see, the U.S. presence is not even hidden anymore. You know, they don't even have the decency to pretend that they're not the power behind the throne in Saudi Arabia.
Lawrence Klayman, lawyer.
Certain countries have been targets of the United States with regard to terrorism, yet the biggest country involved in terrorism is Saudi Arabia. They finance it, and we have treated them with kid gloves. We have treated them as if they're not involved in terrorism at all. Is that because of groups like Carlyle that have significant investments with Saudi Arabian interests? Is that because George W. Bush's father is in fact part of the Carlyle group and is close to the bin Laden family? And that is why we asked George W. Bush to have his father remove himself from the Carlyle group, because it presents a conflict of interest, or at least the appearance of a conflict of interest.
Stephen Norris, ex-director of Carlyle Group.
I believe the Carlyle people, at least when I was there, and I know in my own situation, we spent an awful lot of time thinking about that and worrying about that.
Thinking about what?
About the appearances of things. About how something we do might be perceived, and whether we care or not about it. And honestly, we simply believe that we had something to offer to the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and to other people with whom we invested in, and that people quite legitimately had built up a portfolio of friends and acquaintances and business experience and knowledge of how to deal in high-pressure situations, the tendencies of people, what they might do. We think that's a good thing.
When your son is the sitting president of the United States, interacting with the same countries and ruling elites that you and your company are interacting with, it's pretty apparent that there's a conflict issue here. And the problem is, very few people in this country are talking about this. No one really wants to go there. There have been a few sporadic news stories about Carlyle, and there have been a few skunks at the garden party, like myself, talking about the former president. But generally speaking, the glare of publicity and the spotlight of public attention has not been put on former President Bush or his son about this problem.
If the American people knew all the connections between prominent Republicans and Democrats in our country, with Saudi Arabia, with all of these institutions that
personal
have been
personal relationships you're talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, business and personal relationships with these institutions that have far more to do with funding and sustaining terrorism than Iraq does, George W. Bush would not be reelected in 2004.
This is George W. Bush, the President of the United States. At this moment, the regime of Saddam Hussein is being removed from power, and a long era of fear and cruelty is ending. American and coalition forces are now operating inside Baghdad, and we will not stop until Saddam's corrupt gang is gone.
I think among the key strategists for the war on Iraq in the Bush administration, there's definitely a notion of seeing this as part of their plan to transform relationships in the Persian Gulf. And so I think their feeling is if that they can have a pliable regime in Baghdad that will play ball on oil politics and so forth, they'll be far better positioned to deal with Saudi Arabia.
If they can remake Iraq into their image, under U.S. control, it'll be much more pliable regime than the Saudis, and they'll have much more freedom of operation in the Middle East. They won't have to depend so much on Saudi Arabia, and they'll have this client state in Iraq.
In the new era that is coming to Iraq, your country will no longer be held captive to the will of a cruel dictator. You will be free, free to build a better life.
If the U.S. actually takes over Iraq and does this whole rebuilding, they're going to have to rebuild their telecommunications systems. You know, if you're a clever investor and you want to think for the long term, surely they would be thinking telecom. That's one area. The other area, of course, would be defense. United Defense has very, you know, extensive investments in Turkey and extensive joint ventures in Turkey and Saudi Arabia. If the U.S. installs a pro-U.S. government, you know that the defense contracts in Iraq are going to go to American companies as well.
Big market, and it's a wealthy country.
And what kind of business opportunity for Carlisle could there be in Iraq?
Well, I think they're going to be investing in companies that provide infrastructure initially, road building, bridge building, telecommunications building companies, establishing all kinds of things, selling refrigerators, selling setting up a cell phone system, selling handsets to the average Iraqi is going to want to have the same cell phone they have in Kuwait. So the big market.
So it's going to be a big opportunity there.
I think it'd be a big opportunity.
Well, since that film was made 7 years ago, Carlisle appear to have gone from strength to strength. Their website boasts of 24 years of, and I quote, relentless pursuit of generating superior returns for our investors. And indeed, generating superior returns for investors is number one of their mission objectives. Wikipedia reports in their 2010 annual report that they are managing over $150 billion worth of assets. Not to blind you with statistics, but they're obviously no small player. Now, Wikipedia also reports they have 495 investment professionals. So, averaging out, call it 500 people in charge of $150,000 million. I make that $300 million per person. You may wish to reflect on those numbers at the conclusion of our second film, Ethos, which suggests that conscientious spending can bring about a better world through the power of the market. But I don't want to put you off the next film called Ethos, most of which appears thoroughly sensible and well-intentioned, and features a lot of the voices and themes familiar to regular listeners of the show. The film starts with a dedication to the memory of Howard Zinn. Our ethos is what we currently hold to be true. It is what we act upon. It governs our manners, our business, and politics.
Our home, the planet Earth, is in a galaxy just like this one. Every point of light you can see in this picture is a star, just like our sun. To give you a sense of scale, it would take 100,000 years traveling at the speed of light to get from one side to the other. A short time ago, NASA took a picture of what appeared to be an empty piece of space. A few days later, they developed this image. Every one of these points of light is a galaxy, just like ours. There are more than 3,000 galaxies in this one image. We live in a universe of unfathomable scale and incredible beauty. This really is a universe of infinite possibilities. This is the miracle of our existence. We've been given the opportunity to make our lives a paradise among the stars. But we've fallen far short of that. Is there something inherently wrong with the human race? Is that what we should think of ourselves? I don't believe we are fatally flawed, but we are fallible. We have tried to set up forms of law and government that safeguard the public good. But we haven't maintained the integrity of these systems, and they've been left open to abuse. I don't know anyone who hasn't expressed concern about one issue or another, from politics to poverty or seemingly endless wars. And depending on who you listen to, we could be headed for disaster and upheaval in every aspect of our lives, from the environment to our own personal liberty. But at a time when it's crucial that we're all involved in decisions that will affect our lives in very fundamental ways, so many people have just turned away.
Every day we turn on the TV and there's more bad news. Another environmental catastrophe somewhere, or more starving refugees, or innocent victims in war zones. And most of us are busy trying to make ends meet in our own lives, and we see these images and feel helpless to do anything about it. And I think the deep shame we feel about that is paralyzing, certainly one of the reasons that we turn away. The object of this documentary is to look at the flaws in our systems that allow these things to happen, and the mechanisms that actually work against us, and to show you a very simple but powerful way that we can actually change the world we live in. The material for this film is taken from facts available to the public and from interviews with some of today's leading thinkers. However, we do live in a world full of conspiracy theories, and all I ask is that you keep an open mind, but question everything.
Politics, politicians, democracy, and the lack thereof.
Because people have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Indeed, I did have a relationship with Miss Lewinsky.
I think that gay marriage should be allowed. I do not believe that gay marriages should be legal.
I am honored to be here with Barack Obama. So shame on you, Barack Obama.
Iran, Cuba, Venezuela, these countries are tiny compared to the Soviet Union. They don't pose a serious threat to us. Iran is a great threat.
They contradict each other. They contradict themselves. They will say or do anything to get elected.
We can end illegal immigration.
We're never ever going to be able to totally control immigration.
And every day, it's more lies, more deceit, more corruption.
We have a safe and sound banking system.
I think the system basically is sound.
It's difficult to take these people seriously. And little wonder people have turned away from politics. Only 30% of Americans voted in the 2004 elections. And that was in the middle of a war.
You have said in the past that it was, quote, pretty well confirmed.
No, I never said that.
Okay.
I never
think
said
that is...
No, it's absolutely not. What I said was, it's been pretty well confirmed.
There are known knowns. There are things we know that we know. There are known unknowns. That is to say, there are things that we now know we don't know. But there are also unknown unknowns. There are things we do not know we don't know.
The truth is, there's really very little difference between them. That may seem counterintuitive, but when you look at the voting records, foreign policy, and opinions, the idea that they're very different begins to break down quite quickly. They vote the same an average of 84% of the time.
There's a couple of completely logical reasons why our politicians are so similar. The end game for politicians is to get elected. The people who vote are, for the most part, quite moderate in their views. Both parties try to occupy that middle, moderate ground. They are simply responding to that majority in order to get elected. The second reason our politicians are so similar is much more sinister. They answer increasingly to the same master.
Bill Hogan, the Center for Public Integrity.
Thank you so much. We're looking easily at the first $1 billion presidential election, and it's much bigger money than we've ever seen in a presidential election. We define a candidate as being serious or not by how much money they can raise, not by what ideas they have, what their record in public service might have been. It's all about money. We really don't have an election anymore. We have an auction. And what's for sale? I mean, these are interesting questions to ask. Every incoming president rewards big donors with ambassadorships and other honorary appointments like that. There are all kinds of policy issues. Is a big donor rewarded with a place on a federal advisory panel that might have something to do with, say, approving new drugs or environmental regulations? All of these questions about what's for sale. You know, is government for sale? Is the White House for sale? And I think a lot of Americans suspect that it is. Money flows in for a reason, and the reason is not good government.
It is completely unrealistic to expect democracy to deliver representatives who will serve the people's interests when so much money is involved. Having so much money in politics gives all the power to those with money. Yes, we are all still allowed to vote, but how free is our choice? The media in the hands of big business will only present us with politicians that will serve their interests. It would be completely illogical for them to do otherwise. It would also be illogical to expect politicians to change a system that puts them in power. But it certainly begs the question, just what kind of democracy do we have?
Noam Chomsky, MIT professor.
Do you want to live in a democratic society, or do you want to live in the society we have, which, remember, is not a democratic society and is not intended to be? If you take a course in political theory here, I'm sure they'll teach you that the United States is not a democracy. It's what's called in the technical literature a polyarchy. A polyarchy is a system in which power resides in the hands of those whom Madison called the wealth of the nation, the responsible class of men, and the rest of the population is fragmented. That's the way the country was founded.
Tony Benn, British Member of Parliament.
Throughout the history of the world, the rich and powerful have dominated it, and very few people have had any control of their own governments. The most real power in the world is still exercised by those we do not elect. We are still far from governing ourselves. The basis of democracy is the belief that we were all born equal and that that equality must be accepted by those in power. But in the attempts to win those rights, many people have been imprisoned and tortured by those who have power and were determined to retain it.
In the period of the 1980s, there was a major counter-revolution against democracy. President Reagan in America, Mrs. Thatcher in Britain, I think they realized that if there wasn't something done to change it, democracy would succeed. And they said, we're not having that. No one in power really wants democracy, because democracy would challenge their power structures and their authority. So anyone who comes out with a democratic idea is dismissed as unrepresentative or a troublemaker or an extremist or something. And in this way, the full flow of a public debate about alternatives is being extinguished.
Big business is about making money. That's what big business does well. Governments, however, have to balance the needs of the whole society, including big business, based on ethics and social and moral responsibility. But if our corporations have become more powerful than our governments, then we have to understand the effect that is going to have on our systems.
100 years ago, the corporation was relatively insignificant. But today, the corporation has become the most dominant institution in our society.
Howard Zinn, historian and author.
Corporations are artificial creations. You might say they're monsters trying to devour as much profit as possible at anyone's expense. The 14th Amendment was passed at the end of the Civil War to give equal rights to black people. And what happens is the corporations come into court, and corporation lawyers are very clever, and they say, oh, you can't deprive a person of life, liberty, or property. We are a person. A corporation is a person. And the Supreme Court goes along with that.
Having acquired the legal rights of a person, the question then arises, just what kind of person is a corporation?
These are a special kind of persons which are designed by law to be concerned only for their stockholders, and not, say, what are sometimes called their stakeholders, like the community or the workforce or whatever.
I believe the mistake that a lot of people make when they think about corporations is they think, you know, corporations are like us, have feelings, they have politics, they have belief systems. They really only have one thing, the bottom line.
All publicly traded corporations have been structured through a series of legal decisions to have a very disturbing characteristic. They are required, by law, to place the financial interests of their owners above everything else, even the public good.